More than any other korban that might be presented to the Lord, the olah symbolizes this complete and total reckless surrender to God. It stands in the stead of its owner as a token of complete selfless devotion of one's entire essence. In that respect, it's symbolic of the total tzaddik, the completely righteous person. His will and essence completely surrendered to God. His life is a living sacrifice, a holy sacrifice, acceptable to God. Such is the Master, the living korban olah of the eternal altar. Now it says here that the animal was to be regarded as a substitute for the offerer, offered at the doorway of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. So in the Torah, the sacrifice is a symbolic substitute for the offerer. Ordinarily, but not always, the olah, the burnt offering, is a voluntary sacrifice that the offerer brings because, simply because, he desires to draw near to God. Jewish tradition teaches that the olah could only be brought with great joy of heart. It couldn't be brought reluctantly. An animal that was reluctantly offered as an olah was not considered to be a proper sacrifice. All of the voluntary offerings were to be brought with joyful heart and gladness. So we read in Psalm 27 where David exclaims, "I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. Yes, I will sing praises to the Lord." As we study the temple, we find that sacrificing in the Bible was always considered to be a joyous rite. It was a privilege in which men sought to participate. It was accompanied by music, song, prayer, and worship. The man bringing the olah found fulfillment and communion with God through the ritual of his sacrifice. His soul was happy. He felt privileged to be able to come into God's temple with his korban. His heart beat with expectation when he brought his animal to the temple. When we realize that these sacrifices were not brought as a punishment for sin, not brought in a sense of cowering fear and reluctance, but out of a glad heart, a heart which sought to come near to God, then we are beginning to grasp the biblical perspective of true worship and the biblical perspective on sacrifice. Leviticus 1:4 says, "He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf." The first ritual procedure in offering any animal korban, except for birds, turtle doves, was the laying on of hands. The act of smicha implied a physical leaning on the animal so that the full weight of the man is transferred to the animal, symbolizing an investment of identity. The same laying on of hands terminology is used in Numbers 8:10, where all Israel is to lay hands upon the Levites to designate them as surrogates to serve in the temple. We find it again in Numbers 27 when God commands Moses to lay his hands on Joshua, thereby appointing Joshua as the new Moses, the new leader of Israel. Through leaning his hands on Joshua, Moses invests him with his authority. Joshua becomes a substitute for Moses. In Judaism, judges, elders, and rabbis were all ordained through the ritual of laying on of hands. In the apostolic scriptures, laying on of hands confers healing to the sick. The Holy Spirit is conferred by laying on of hands. Elders and deacons are ordained through the laying on of hands. The laying on of hands is considered to be one of the elementary truths of the Messianic faith. In each of these instances, the laying on of hands symbolizes a transfer of identity. Through the laying on of hands, the one leaning confers his identity onto the one being leaned upon. The Levites are invested with the identity of all Israel. Joshua invested with the identity of Moses. Judges, elders, rabbis, and deacons transfer their authority and office to new judges, elders, rabbis, and deacons through the laying on of hands. When a man leaned his hands on the head of an animal, he invested his identity into that animal. The animal was then meant to represent him before the Lord in the Holy Temple. The worshiper is to lay his hands on the animal and offer it in his place, in his stead, in order that it might make atonement for him. Atonement is kafar. But in what sense are we to understand this atonement? One might assume that the sacrifice is meant as an atonement for sin, but this is not exactly accurate. The Torah's use of the term atonement, kafar, certainly can imply the forgiveness of sin and the removal of guilt, but it's not limited to those applications. Instead, kafar is a much broader term, and it may be used to imply a protective covering. The Torah Club studies point out that the word kafar can be rendered as ransom for one's life. Both these meanings apply in a ritual context, the ritual context of Israel's worship system. In the instructions for the building of the tabernacle, we saw that the priesthood, the altar, the furnishings, and even the tabernacle itself all required atonement in the sense of covering. They all needed to be covered in order to stand in the presence of God. They hadn't sinned. The altar had not sinned. The furnishings of the tabernacle had not sinned. They did not need their sins forgiven. So atonement is a much broader concept than simply the forgiveness of sins. But without atonement, without covering, those tabernacle elements could not have survived the encounter with the consuming spirit of the Almighty. The same is also true for the worshiper that seeks to draw near to God. God is dangerous. To be near to God is to be in jeopardy. The sacrificial system is a means by which those who desired to draw near to Him could safely do so, albeit through surrogate agency. Fragile, mortal flesh cannot survive His presence. The man must send a surrogate on his behalf. Thus, we should understand Levitical atonement primarily as a covering atonement, in the sense of a protective shelter from the manifest presence of God who occupied the physical space of the temple on earth. That's a critically important point. It's critical that we understand this function. Sacrifices were not brought as a means to attain salvation. They were not brought to clear the sinner's conscience. They were not brought to provide forgiveness for sins. The writer of the book of Hebrews makes it quite clear that the sacrifices were not intended to remove sin or regenerate the sinner when he says, "It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins," Hebrews 10:4. In another place, he explains that the sacrifices could not even cleanse the conscience because they were only intended to relate to matters of the flesh, the body, not the spirit or the soul. Hebrews 9:9-10, gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body, for the flesh. Believers misunderstand the sacrificial system because they view it through the grid of Old Covenant versus New Covenant dispensationalist theology. We make the mistake of assuming that prior to the death and resurrection of Yeshua, people's sins were actually forgiven and salvation was actually procured through their participation in the sacrificial rites, and we thereby assign efficacy unto eternal salvation to the rites of animal sacrifice, up until Yeshua's death. But if this were actually true, think about it, then Yeshua did not need to die at all. God did not need to send His Son. Rather, His sacrifice and death were simply a matter of convenience for us. It is convenient that we no longer need to offer animal sacrifices to procure eternal salvation, but if not for Yeshua, the sacrifice of bulls and goats would suffice us. Is this what we believe? That's a ridiculous idea. But if the sacrifices were not brought for the forgiveness of sins and securing eternal salvation, what were they meant for? It's hard for us to understand because there is no temple in our day. There is no place where one can go and enter into a holy space occupied by the manifest presence of God anymore. But if there were, then we would better understand the need for atonement as it pertains to entering God's space, God's presence in this world. The sacrifices and temple rituals pertained to drawing near to God, drawing near to God within His holy precincts. They were rituals for the temple in this present world. The writer of the book of Hebrews makes this clear with a Kol Vahomer argument. He argues that if animal sacrifices were efficacious as regards the flesh, how much more so is the sacrifice of Messiah efficacious as regards the spirit? Listen to this passage in Hebrews 9, beginning in verse 13. He says, For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling those who have been defiled sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Messiah, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?